So our first presenter is Bruce Hare from Syracuse University, and was a public school teacher in New York, he was telling me at one point.
Good afternoon. Good afternoon. Thank you. It is indeed an honor and a privilege to be asked to come and speak, to speak at a forum organized in honor of Malcolm. And it's even centrally important to me to be coming here and being asked to speak about the children and about the nature of the educational system and about the relationship between the life chances of the children and the educational systems that we stick them inside of. There's been a lot of noise about our kids. Our kids have been trampled on, they've been stereotyped, they've been treated as if they were born by spontaneous combustion, 13 years old on the corner, 14 years old on the train, born to mug. And I was at one point in 88, I'm going to share pieces of a paper I wrote called the Black Youth at Risk. This appeared as a chapter in the National Urban League's annual publication called The State of Black America in 1988. It's called Black Youth at Risk, and I will lay out hopefully a framework on where the kids are in the general sense of where the kids are and where we are in America and what it means to be black in America and the role of the schools in America. And then I'll share some information that I have regarding the struggle that we lost here some 20 years ago that may have much to do with understanding why the New York City public schools are in the condition that they're in. For purposes of information, I am a native New Yorker. I was born in Harlem Hospital. I grew up in Harlem in the Bronx. And I also am a former Head Start teacher in New York City at the Manhattanville Child Development Center. And I also taught fifth grade for 2 years at IS 201. On 127th in Madison. So I thought it's important to say that because while I'm now a professor of sociology and professor and chair of the Department of African American Studies at Syracuse University, I also want it known that I hopefully speak and do speak also as a native Harlemite and as a former fifth grade teacher about the schools. I want to kind of title my remarks. I kept trying to think about how to frame it, and I decided I would title my remarks Forward to the Past. In the era of Back to the Future, it is actually quite possible, and I would argue even necessary, to go forward to the past in order to go back to the future. Because we've lost something somewhere between there and here. Not the least of which is we've lost contact with, in many ways, what the meaning of the life of Malcolm was, and what Malcolm represented, what Malcolm had in Revelations, the same way we've lost contact with Martin. Now, these folks have been, don't die is the moral to that story, because you get recooked and refried and repackaged and sent back out and don't look anything like what you were about when you were around. So I want to share with you rather than ramble, because I've worked very hard to try to make these things efficient, and then hopefully at the end of our panels we'll have some opportunity to talk. As I said, in 88 I was asked to write a chapter for the State of Black America. And I did, and we had a press conference at the National Press Club in Washington, D.C. John Jacobs, the president of the league, and other people who had written chapters, including Lee Brown, before he became police commissioner here. There was an assistant named Diane Pendeuse who wrote about blacks and the American political system. There was a brother named David Swinton who wrote about blacks and the economic state of black America. There was another sister who was the president of a college and wrote about black higher education. What was fascinating at this press conference is that all these people wanted to talk about was our kids in crime. It didn't matter what somebody hit the podium to talk about. All these 100 reporters wanted to talk about were our kids in crime. And that's when I said to them, you people act like our kids are born by spontaneous combustion. You ought to develop an appetite for trying to figure out about the crimes before the crimes. The question is, what happens to bring these children to this moment that you are then ready and eager to discuss, operating under the profound and very simple assumption that God distributes human potential equitably across children? You people seem to forget that these kids had equal childhood potential. You seem to forget that these were once little infants bouncing on their mama's knees and giggling in their father's arms, that these were once kids that you thought were cute, So somewhere between the moment when they were cute little things to you and this nightmare moment where you stereotyped them as dangerous, something happened to them. And what I began then to address with them is what I want to share with you is an assessment of what it is that happens to them, what kinds of things would our youngsters look like, what would they need, and what's happening that is between them and the achievement of their destiny. So I want to share with you parts of this chapter titled Black Youth at Risk. There comes a period in every person's life when the task of moving from childhood dependence to adult independence is to be undertaken. It is ideally at this time that a fusion of mental readiness and structural opportunity make this passage possible. The continuous and smooth movement of youth from childhood to adulthood, from school to work, from their parents' abodes to their own abode is essential both to the future well-being of the individual and the society. Thus, it is in the interest of a society to provide its young people both the training, aptitudes, and the opportunities or structures necessary to accomplish these tasks. Were such conditions being optimally accomplished for African-American youth, they would be demonstrating a pattern of self-development at the very least commensurate with that of their white and more likely middle-class counterparts. They would be raised in psychologically and economically stable homes, successful in school, optimistic about their progress and their futures, and successfully transitioning from school to work. They would furthermore, as black youth, demonstrate patterns of self-discipline and commitment to self, family, and community, reflecting the legacy of struggle for equity and justice of which they are a part. Such does, however, not appear to be the case. Not only do our youth remain disadvantaged as regards other youth, but they are at greater risk than at any time in recent history. Not only are they being denied their structural opportunities as reflected in their highest high school dropout, and here I add, eviction rates. My colleagues write about dropout rates, I write about eviction rates. When you can't process 2 out of 10 kids, I might be willing to talk to you about what's the matter with the child's motivation and the parental cooperation and things of that sort. When you can't process 6 out of 10, 5 out of 10, when I have to flip a coin to find out whether or not a child's going to get a high school diploma, as you have to do in Cleveland, the attrition rate is 50%. I argue that is not a dropout rate, that is in fact an eviction rate. And there's no other business that could stay in business failing at that rate, which then caused me, as you will see, to write about what I call the functional value of educational failure. One can argue, unfortunately, that the schools in many ways succeed when they fail. One of the reasons that that success exists in a symbol is one can imagine that every day there are two parades in these great tall buildings in New York. We identify with the day parade. We identify with the men and women who go into these tall buildings, sashaying around with attaché cases, seeking fame and fortune. But when those people come down out those buildings at 5 o'clock and get in their cars and get on those buses and get on those trains and get out of town before it gets dark, a second parade takes place. And into those very same buildings goes a whole other herd of humans. I've come to call them the worker bees of life, the stagehands of life. Their job is to go into those very same buildings and wax those floors and sweep those floors and clean up those bathrooms and erase those blackboards and fix those Xerox machines, symbolically set the stage so the prima donnas can come back in and sashay again in the morning. The problem is that that labor is both necessary and unrespected. And the labor is principally unrespected the way American capitalism fails to respect, and that is, it isn't paid well. It therefore becomes undesirable work. So then you have a paradox. You have necessary work and unattractive necessary work, low-paying, unattractive necessary work. The question becomes, how do you produce people who will do those jobs? The answer is eviction rates. The answer is that you have people who are trained to believe in equal educational opportunity, who fail in a structured failed system, and then they are proximate because they have failed. They have to be nearby to work for next to nothing because they can't afford to get to nowhere to work for nothing. So they are proximate. They are programmed to believe in equal opportunity, and therefore when they fail, they internalize that failure as their own fault. They're there in proximate, cheap, and prepared to do the work of these functions. In this sense, I say to you in no uncertain terms that Harlem and the South Bronx do for New York City what Soweto does for Johannesburg. Not only then are our children being denied their rights, being denied their structural opportunities as reflected in these high eviction rates, their lowest college attendance, and their well beyond 50% unemployment rate. Don't listen to the tube. Unemployment statistics are only about the people who are still looking. But these kids also reflect, let's be real, alarming attitudinal formations as well. These youth reflect a lower sense of control over their destinies and an absence of the political and collective consciousness as would unfortunately be expected of children of the post-civil rights, post-black nationalist eras. They are subsequently short on mentors and long on rugged individualism. The soaring rates of out-of-wedlock births, babies having babies, among increasingly young black girls with irresponsible and abandoning boys, the rising crime and drug abuse rates, and the increasing violence committed by our youth against each other and our elders speaks to a rising despair and a declining discipline among our youth. While we recognize the role of the Reagan era and the national economy in general and the climate that has existed in racist America and capitalist racist America, we cannot afford to be content with system blame and allow an entire generation of our children to go down the drain. It is within this context, then, that this analysis of the state of our kids will be undertaken. Such an analysis, however, could not be undertaken in a theoretical vacuum and will thus be accompanied by an analysis of the workings of the American social system and the state of black people in America. The overview is called On Being Black in America. It should be stated from the outset that this view of the condition of black Americans begins from the premise that is largely environment rather than any mystical within-group biological or cultural disorder, which is responsible for the overrepresentation of black Americans among the losers in the society. Much as a slave may have been defined as ill or maladaptive for failing to adjust to slavery, we have failed to adjust to poverty, to racism, and to discrimination. For as long as the recognition of the disadvantaged status of our people has existed, an assortment of explanations have been advanced and forward to justify their disproportionate location in the lowest slots of the system. The notion of biological genetic inferiority is an example of the bad genes approach to the analysis of the condition of our people. This is ideological warfare, by the way. It's nothing short of ideological warfare. And the reason why you can know that particularly biological determinism was unfolded as biological warfare, because some of you may not know that the father of IQ was a man named Sir Cyril Burt. Burt was a British psychologist who did work on heritability. He was trying to find out whether or not your genes or your environment most determine your life chances. And he claimed if you studied twins, you could really test it because they were genetically identical. So he said if you studied twins who were separated early in their lives and you found out that they both did well or they both did bad, even though they grew up in disparate environments, he argued you have evidence that heritability operated, that their genes were determining their life chances. He studied this stuff, and then he reported back that sure enough, it didn't matter whether one child grew up in poverty and the other one grew up in wealth, their life chances were the same, their life chances were determined by their genes. The British Crown loved it. He wrote about it, he quoted two other people studying the same stuff, they concluded the same thing he concluded. The British elite liked it so much that they sirred Cyril, they actually sirred him. The psychologist became Sir Cyril Burt. They said, Cyril, we like this stuff. We really like this stuff, because in the end, the stuff said the cream rises to the top. The stuff told the elites that they belonged where they were because they were innately superior. About 15 years ago, some smart researchers in the ideological war went looking for the birth and death records of Sir Cyril's twins. They found out that Sir Cyril's twins never existed. Cyril made the twin stuff up. Cyril said, why should I go out here looking for separated twins when I can sit in my office and make it up? Said they should have never separated in the first place. Then somebody said, well, let's go find Cyril's co-authors. Let's go find the people he was quoting. They went looking for the birth and death record of these two other authors who Cyril was quoting and quoting, and he was quoting them and they were quoting him. That's right. They never existed either. Cyril wrote under two aliases, made up all kinds of data, got himself served somewhere down there. Cyril's laughing at us. But Cyril is the ideological father of the IQ movement. They called him the father of IQ. He's the ideological grandfather of the Shockleys and the Jensens and the other pathological biogenetic ideologues. I simply say to you that that didn't stop Jensen and Shockley from running around on the tube. That school of thought didn't die. And so I say to you that when the foundation is blown to smithereens, the father of IQ is found to be a fraud, and the tradition still stands, then we know that something more than science is at work. A revised and more liberal, although equally devastating argument appears with the emergence of cultural inferiority notions. This justification of discrimination shifts the blame from the genes of the group to the culture of the group, while suddenly retaining what William Ryan calls a victim-blame focus. While the second explanation does represent a kind of progress under the assumption that culture can be improved, both perspectives serve to maintain the locus of the blame within the group itself while leaving the system unchallenged. In neither mode, then, is it posited as a tenable hypothesis that differential attainment is a requirement of the American social order, and that processes are operating within the system that increase the probability that black Americans will be disproportionately allocated to the lowest slots. While acknowledging the relative underattainment of black Americans, this author writes a third and takes a third ideological perspective in search of explanation, that being that the relative academic and subsequent economic failure of black Americans in the American social order is functional, if not intended, given racism and the differential distribution of wealth, power, and privilege in the social structure. It is posited that both biological and cultural explanations serve largely to justify current race, class, and gender inequalities. Furthermore, it is argued that the myth of equal opportunity serves as a smokescreen through which the losers will be led to blame themselves and be seen by others as getting what they deserve. One might simply ask, for example, how can both inheritance of wealth for some and equal opportunity for all exist in the same social system? How? That's a contradiction of the highest order. People just don't stop those two elevators at the same floor on their head at the same time. I saw a movie called The Young Joe Kennedy, and at the end of this movie, Joe Kennedy Sr., the robber baron, says to his son, "You are my oldest son. It is your 16th birthday. I'm a very rich and very powerful and very famous man. I've done this for you and your mother and your brothers. But because this is your 16th birthday and you are my oldest son, I'm here to tell you that you can become anything that you want and I will back you to the hilt." The son leaned back, puffed on his cigar, and said, "I believe I'll become the first Irish Catholic president of the United States." In the real world, he died in the military, and his brother John went and did exactly that. The mirror image comes from the early rap music of the 1960s. The lyric comes from the Temptation in the mirror image. They said, "Papa was a rolling stone. Wherever he laid his hat was his home. And when he died, all he left us was alone." Now, if you think those two kids have the same life chance, I've got a bridge here that I'd like to sell you. Bowles and Ginsis posit that the unequal distribution of wealth, power, and privilege is and historically has been the reality of American capitalism, and that such a system must produce educational and occupational losers. This writer further argues in what he terms a class plus analysis, with classism as the engine and racism as the caboose, that black Americans have simply been chosen to absorb an unfair share of an unfair burden in a structurally unfair system. Some statistics. The March 1986 issue of Crisis presents a series of dire statistics on black youth. For example, it is reported that 86% of black youth live in poverty. One of every 22 black American males will be killed by a violent crime. 51% of violent crime in the U.S. is committed by black youth. This is NAACP publication. One out of every six black males will be arrested by the time they reach age 19. 40% of black children are being raised in single-parent homes, principally with mothers. The magazine also puts the current high school so-called dropout rate at 72%. Given the structural issues presented and the already known precarious status of the adults, one might wonder specifically how a people of equal innate childhood potential arrive at such a disadvantaged youth status. To be sure, early indicators do exist in the over 45% unemployment rate of black youth, but the process of structuring differential perception and access and attainment among black youngsters has begun early on in the role of the schools. It has been said that schools are places that people attend the most and know the least about. Education for Black Americans remains a symbolic key for advancement. The historic 54 Supreme Court decision declaring segregated schools inherently unequal represented what many hope would be a turning point. Many believed it would bring an end to inferior education. However, over 30 years later, the dream of the Brown decision remains to be realized, particularly in our cities. The underlying desegregation notion that sprinkling a few Black children in a predominantly white school would not depreciate the assumed higher quality of education, and the other notion that sprinkling a few white children in a predominantly Black school would appreciate the quality, are both racist and questionable notions. However, the fact that the wait for desegregation has allowed for significant, in the meantime, declines in predominantly Black urban school systems is unquestionable. The education of our youth in these schools has largely become an exercise in social control and babysitting by outsiders. While much has been written about the achievement gaps between Blacks and other ethnic groups on standardized tests as through suggestions concerning their innate ability, their motivational problems of the youngsters, less has been written and offered about the possible role of the schools and teachers in the creation and forwarding of such differences. Nevertheless, there exists a body of literature on teacher expectations and differential treatment of children of different characteristics that might shed alternative light on the causes of these achievement differences. While conventional wisdom would have us believe that every child begins the great quest for status at the same starting line with the same track shoes, with only aptitude determining placement at the finish line, there's ample evidence to suggest that such egalitarian theories are myths and distortions of fact. For example, Cicero and Kitsu examined this assumption in a study of educational decision makers and concluded that quite the opposite is true. They report that their research supports the view that students' progress in the sequence of transitions is contingent upon the student's biography, social and personal adjustment, appearance and demeanor, social class and social type, as well as their demonstrated ability and performance. They concluded that the professed ideal of equal access to educational opportunity for those of equal ability is not necessarily served by such procedures. We can go on those. Lavin points out, in a study on predicting academic performance, he concluded that some evidence suggests that implicit subjective criteria are involved in teacher grading practices. We refer here to the possibility that certain characteristics of the student, such as their gender, social class background, race, affect the quality of the relationship between the student and the teacher. The traditional literature said that girls did better in the elementary schools than boys, European American girls, and that the boys took the lead later on and never relinquished that lead. It hit me one day. It can't be completely divorced from the fact that the women dominate the elementary school classrooms, and when the men take over the classrooms, the boys take over the lead. Commonality breeds consensus. There's less noise. The more you share and have in common with the child, the better the probability. It explains why Puerto Rican boys and African American boys are in deep trouble in the public schools dominated by middle-class European American women, because those women share neither gender, ethnicity, nor social class background with those boys. As previously noted, the school plays a unique role in allocating people to different positions in the division of labor through routing and grading practices. Relative success in school is, in fact, the major avenue through which discrimination in the job market is justified. Given racism, as well as sexism and classism in stratified capitalist America, it has been posited that the disproportional allocation of Black Americans, of women, and people of lower class origins to the lowest labor slots is functional, and that their relative academic failure is essential for getting the job done. For example, such normal procedures as differentially allocating girls to home economics and sewing courses while lower class youngsters, while boys go to shop, lower class youngsters to slower tracks, and African American and Puerto Rican kids in this city to compensatory programs or common school practices with long-term educational and occupational implications. Thus, it is argued that structured educational failure legitimizes job discrimination while eliminating legal recourse. You can't sue anybody for not giving you a job if you can't even fill out the job application. This is the new discrimination. Let them in there, but don't teach them a damn thing. Let them go out completely unqualified. Now, when I wrote this, I shared it with one of my colleagues at Stony Brook before I moved up to Syracuse. And one of my colleagues said, laid back, said, Bruce, what are you trying to say? What are you trying to say? You're trying to say white men stay awake at night conspiring to oppress women and minorities? Mm-hmm. I said, that's a very good question. That's an excellent question. I said, in fact, that question is so excellent that I'm not going to answer it today. I'm going to go home and meditate that question. Because when you get heavy questions, you ought to think about it. Don't come out the cuff, right? I went home over the weekend. I came back on Monday and I just smiled at him and I thanked him for asking me that question. And this also answers the whole question of conspiracy as being purported in the newspapers at this time. The number of angles on that, one is just because I'm paranoid doesn't mean I'm not oppressed. I always like that one. That's very clear. Of course, unfortunately, it's also true, just because I'm oppressed doesn't mean I'm not paranoid. But what I also pointed out here was that, yes, sometimes these conscious conspiracies take place, but as you'll see, I also pointed out that Newton's law of inertia becomes relevant here. So I said to him, it should be noted that such a process does not require a conscious conspiracy to operate. Rather, it is posited that Newton's law of inertia regarding material objects is also applicable to notions. Begging the issue of origins, continuing educational discriminatory practices merely require that school personnel, like other people, act on socialized unconscious beliefs and established stereotypes, which then have the capacity to become self-fulfilling prophecies. I said to him, such a process, therefore, requires a conspiracy to stop. It does not require a conspiracy to continue. Leastways, not a conscious conspiracy. It is, in fact, an object in motion. There's little reason, then, to assume that if such processes and practices and beliefs exist in the general culture, they would not be operative in the school. The fact that the schools simultaneously homogenize attitudes and create self-blaming individuals while differentiating skills increases the probability that the youngsters themselves will accept these outcomes as the consequence of their own attributes or deficiencies. So this discussion, while not denying the existence of achievement gaps, has attempted to offer a structural analysis alternative to the conventional victim-type blame notion. Such a process appears not at all inconsistent with reporting findings of gross race differences in the academic arena. The other issue here is academic alienation as caused by the curricula of the schools. What kinds of stories these kids are told, what kinds of stories these kids are not told. With briefness, I'll tell you the two great cornerstones of the Eurocentric racist nature of American public education. The first one comes with the crime of commission, as Carter G. Woodson calls it, the deliberate distortion of historical facts. Columbus did not discover America. You cannot discover an occupied place. The Columbus myth is psychologically profoundly dangerous. There was a retired professor from a Northwestern named Carew, wrote an article called Columbus and the Origins of Racism in America. Every time they tell these children that Columbus discovered America, they throw 10,000 years of American history out the window. You cannot discover an occupied place. Flip Wilson reduced it to its absurd beauty. Flip Wilson said the Indians were on the beach celebrating not having been discovered yet, Dave, when Chris came. In 1346, a Native American was cited as having asked a member of the Spanish crown. In 1346, he asked the member of the Spanish crown, why do you people insist on calling us Indians? They never heard that word till Chris came. Chris only called them Indians because he was looking for India. He said, like, dig, y'all could be Indians, this could be India, and everything could be everything. In 1969, a Native American took an Air Italia flight nonstop from New York to Rome. He got off the plane, took out a spear, stuck that bad boy in the ground, and declared himself discovering Rome. I laughed, he laughed, Walter Cronkite laughed. I asked my students, pray tell, what is the difference? One of my wonderful little European-American students jumped up out of his seat and said, but nobody knew they were there. I said, God help and keep you too, my son. They knew they were there. The second myth is the crime of omission. We go back to Europe with Columbus in the school curricula, all the way up to the college and the university. We ignore the 10,000 years that were here. Vaguely, we heard about it. We heard about the Inca. We heard about the Aztec. We heard about it vaguely out there somewhere in the fog, underneath some spider somewhere hidden away in a library. But don't let that stop you in the competition between Leif Erikson and Christopher Columbus over who was here first. Sheesh. The second crime is we go back to Europe with Columbus, we migrate south in European history, then we stop history artificially at the southern shores of Europe. We failed then to discourse. Took me 15 years as a professor to find a simple sentence for this. We failed to discourse on the African roots of European civilization. We failed to discourse on the African roots of European civilization. Where, pray tell, do you think all those Europeans came from? Spontaneous combustion? Poof, the brothers get born on the train. Shush, Europeans come into existence, differentiated and separated from the rest of the human race. There's only one race, folks. It's the human race. There's the ideology of racism that separates and distorts the continuum of human color variation and the evolution and migration of humans about the planet. Color variations among human beings are nothing more than the adaptation of the animal to the planet over thousands of years of migration. Brownness is camouflage and protection at the equator. Lightness is camouflage and protection at the poles. The equatorial bear is brown, the polar bear is white. Ain't nobody talking about races of bears. Dogs, cats, I don't know what the races would do with a zebra. So these two crimes are profoundly central to the psychology and the ideology of whiteness as an underpinning of the divide and conquer nature of American capitalism. James Baldwin said it very nicely. He said, whiteness is a moral choice. It is not a complexion. You're only as white as you choose to be. My sons at 3 and 5 observed it. My three-year-old said to his brother, I just figured something out. His brother said, what? And Dorian said, they call pink people white. And his brother said, yeah, and they call brown people black. And they fell out their chairs and laughed. They were pre-racialized. All right, I want to just take a few seconds here and say something quick about the New York City schools and then allow my colleagues on, because I could go on all day and I shouldn't. Let me tell you what happened here, for those of you who may not know, at least in my view. We lost the war for the New York City public schools in 67 and 68. We lost the war because there was a struggle, a profound struggle in this city for community control of schools. There was the IS 201 complex, which was originally created under somebody's notion of a magnet school. They thought if they gave Harlem a fancy school, that people would send their children across the bridge, the Triborough Bridge, to school in Harlem. An African American from Queens told me she didn't care whether Jesus himself was in that building. She wasn't sending her kids to school in Harlem. Somebody had a serious illusion about what people were willing to do to put their kids in a fancy building. After the folks recovered from the shock of that dream, they came up with a more realistic dream. They wanted control of their schools. And the community control movement in Harlem was born. And in fact, the Ford Foundation agreed to give Harlem $5 million to play with it. And the Board of Education of the City of New York said, yes, you can have it. Understand, community control is very simple when you break it down. It is the right to hire and fire, and it is control of a budget. If you don't have the right to hire and fire, you don't have control over the budget, you don't have control, period. Harlem was about to get it. Three Bridges was watching, Ocean Hill-Brownsville was watching, everybody was rooting, and Albert Shanker and the United Federation of Teachers called two strikes, and ultimately they pulled every teacher out of every school in the city of New York because they said they'd be damned if they were going to allow Harlem to start the flood of independent school districts. And therein endanger the central relationship between the United Federation of Teachers and the Board of Education of the City of New York. They called a citywide strike. We hadn't done our homework. We didn't have alternative things to do with our children. We hadn't set our churches up to accept them the way the South Bostonians did when they protested the Garrity Order. So we lost that war then. They instituted something that is existing all the way to today, something called decentralization, some obfuscated nonsense, some bull. Some absence of a transfer of control. And you should be very clear on this. I'm still out on some parts of David Dinkins, but Dinkins made a deal with the union in order to become mayor. The status reports on the New York City public schools were issued out of David Dinkins' office, not out of Mayor Koch's office. Why would the Manhattan Borough president be giving us the report on the entire school system? When you read the reports, you find out why. Because that report is so pro-UFT, it's crazy. That report says there's no alternative but decentralization. You know what decentralization gives us even to today? Principals have lifetime tenure in place. If a principal gets tenure in a building, the building belongs to the principal forever, no matter how the children do. Who's the school for? Who's the school for? And the union broke the back of the community control movement. And I say that to say to you then, in order to go back to the future, we do have to go forward to the past. And if I have to reduce what we need to do in this city to a nutshell, it's that we need to rebirth the community control movement. Thank you.